All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Dale Thronberry.
And good afternoon and welcome to Veterans Radio. My name is Dale Thronberry. I was a CW-2 helicopter pilot in Vietnam, 1969, just to establish a little credibility there here on Veterans Radio. You can listen to us here every day, every Sunday, 5 o'clock Eastern Time here on WAAM Talk 1600 in Ann Arbor, Michigan. You can also follow us on the web at veteransradio.net. You've got our archives there. We've got podcasts on there. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter, and I can't think of anywhere else. If you want to follow us, just let us know you're back there. If you want to participate in today's program, you can give us a call here at Veterans Radio, and the number is 734-822-1600. That's 734-822-1600, or toll-free 844-838-1600. That's 844-838-1600. Well, today is the 75th anniversary of the Bataan Death March, and I don't know how many of you are familiar with that, but in the Philippines, at the beginning of World War II, the Philippines were attacked the same day as Pearl Harbor, and in fact, the only difference was that the Philippines also had a land attack going on at the same time, and so there was many things that were happening in there, and we're going to get into the whole story of the Bataan Death March with our guest, John Lucas, in just a moment. But I think it's really important for us to remember that 75 years ago that this occurred. In fact, I got an email just before I came over to the studio announcing again that this is the 75th anniversary on the 9th of April, 1942, but that there is a celebration, I guess you could say, a commemorative gathering in San Francisco of the survivors of the Bataan Death March. And we did a program on this, boy, I'm thinking probably 10 years ago. And we talked with a gentleman down in Detroit who was a survivor, and he just curled our hair when he was telling his stories of this incredible march that these men, Americans and Filipinos, had to go through to get to the prisoner of war camp that they were being kept in. And as I said, we're going to get into more and more of the details of this as we go along. So I want you to stay tuned. Make sure that you turn your radios up for those guys who need to turn them up. If you're listening on the internet, we'll be back in just a moment. We're going to take a quick break and we'll be back with our guests for today's program. John Lucas, and his book is Escape from Davao. And also, he's got a documentary film out there called 4-4-43. We'll explain that when we get back. You're listening to Veterans Radio. And we're back on Veterans Radio, and many of you will recognize that music from our Medal of Honor series. And I played that because the person that we're going to be talking about today, after hearing the story, I think you're going to agree that he deserves at least one Medal of Honor. And so we're going to be talking about him with our guests. But let me kind of read my little promo here. It says, on April 4th, 1943, 10 American prisoners of war and 2 Filipino convicts broke out of the Davao, I know I'm mispronouncing this, but the Davao penal colony, an escape-proof Imperial Japanese Army prison plantation in the Philippines, called the greatest story of the war in the Pacific by the United States War Department in 1944. This astonishing yet true action-adventure tale is told through the eyes of Lieutenant Colonel William Edwin Dias, one of World War II's most extraordinary yet little-known heroes. Well, we're going to learn all about him today, and I think you are going to be amazed at this story. So what I want to do right now is to welcome our guest for the week, and that's John Lucas. He's the producer of a documentary entitled 4-4-43, and we'll talk about that in just a moment. He's also the writer of a book, Escape from Davao, The Forgotten Story of the Most Daring Prison Break in the Pacific War. John, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Dale, thank you very much for having me. It's an honor to be here.
Well, let's just jump right into this whole story. How did you learn about Colonel Dias?
It's it's kind of a long story, and I think, I don't want to take up a few of your shows here for the next couple of weeks, so I'll try to boil it down into sort of a Reader's Digest condensed version. There was an individual that I had gotten to know and met. He was a football player at Notre Dame, and I know you're based up in Michigan, and there's probably some rivalry
We've heard of that school.
Right, you've heard of it down in Indiana, small Catholic school.
Right.
He played at Notre Dame in the 1930s, late 30s. Wasn't a household name. Wasn't a famous player, a Heisman winner. He had a few All-American votes, but nothing that the people would recognize. He was from the South Side of Chicago. His name was Mario Tonelli, and he was pretty good though. He scored the winning touchdown in 1937 to beat Southern Cal, and he was going to play professional football. Was drafted by the Chicago Cardinals, but he was also drafted by Uncle Sam.
Okay.
And he figured that he would, at the time there was a one-year service commitment right before World War II with the Selective Service Act, and he figured, well, I will get in right now on the ground floor, put my ear in, get back home, before any problems break out and go into coaching.
Mm-hmm.
Well, sure enough, he happened to be stationed in the Philippines on December 8th, 1941, and was caught up in the war over there. He was in a Coast Artillery Regiment, an anti-aircraft unit, and participated in the battle for Bataan, and ended up finding himself, on the death march 75 years ago today. And, a fascinating story. He had a class ring, his Notre Dame class ring that he got when he graduated, and, the Japanese are going around stealing all the personal effects and belongings from, mm-hmm. From our prisoners. And he had to give up the class ring. But a few minutes later, he's marching, moving towards the prison camp, and a Japanese guard sort of pulls his group, out of the line and goes through and starts handing back the loot that the guards had previously taken. Hmm. Sure enough, he comes to Tonelli. The Japanese guard, sort of recognizes him. It's a real awkward, strange situation. And all of a sudden, this Japanese officer speaks perfect English, and he says, where's Mario Tonelli? And he has the ring in his hand. And so Tonelli goes over, he goes aside with this Japanese officer, and they have a small conversation, and Tonelli ends up asking, why are you being so nice to me when these other guys are being, they're looted, being killed, mm-hmm. beheaded, tortured on this march? And the Japanese officer said, I was educated in the States before the war. And he said, I went to school at the University of Southern California. I was in the stands the day you scored the winning touchdown to beat us in 1937.
Luckily, it was a small world for him.
Exactly. So, I got my start in sports writing, and this was a famous sort of campus lore story at Notre Dame, and I was able to print it and get some attention. It was a cover story in USA Today about 15 years ago, right around the 60th anniversary of the march, and it was a big hit. And anyway, long story short, I got to know Mr. Tonelli pretty well, and we became good friends, and he told me of this story of these guys who escaped, guys who had been in the death march, but they escaped from a prison camp that he had been in, and he knew Colonel Dias, who you referenced earlier, and a bunch mm-hmm. of these other guys, and I was just, floored that I'd never heard of the story of guys who escaped from the Philippines or anywhere in the Pacific, for that matter, in a large group. And, as soon as he told me this story, it was one of those things where it was, you just take off running, and, and next thing I know, a book came out, and I did the documentary. Now I'm working, for Colonel Dias to get the Medal of Honor. So it's kind of strange how one story leads to another, and it's all, a snowball effect.
Well, it is true, John. We're talking to John Lucas. He's an author, a producer. He's made a documentary about Colonel Dias, and we're going to talk about that a little bit later on. But so, I had never heard of him, and I thought, I thought I knew everything. We've been doing this program for 13 years, and we've heard mm-hmm. a lot of stories about World War II, and even, and the Bataan Death March, but I'd never heard of this gentleman, and the story is so terrifying, but exciting, and it's one of these guys, and I'll let you fill in the blanks. He's from a small town in Texas, and he's always wanted to be a pilot and go from there.
Yeah, Colonel Dias is one of the most interesting figures. I mean, I was in your shoes a few years ago too. I'd never heard of the guy, and I had, I'd grown up. My father was a history teacher, and so I had that sort of background. I'm very inquisitive and interested in history, and obviously, growing up around World War II veterans, Korean Vietnam War veterans, guys. You know, you pick up stories, you pick up information and things, and obviously there's books and movies and all that, but this name never registered before with me. And once I started digging a little bit more, I mean, I was just shocked that, you know, that this type of hero had walked in our midst, you know, albeit 70 years ago, and you know, it was kind of saddened that nobody had heard of him or knew anything about him. But so you weren't the first, and you won't be the last, but hopefully sort of my mission here is to educate more people about him and you know, get the ball rolling in that regard. But yeah, he was a unique individual. He started out just taking some flying lessons as a, you know, as a youngster in this small town in Texas. Barnstormers were coming through after World War I, the 1920s. You know, it was kind of the height of, you know, America's interest in air power and planes at that time. Charles Lindbergh's Crossing the Atlantic really got him started in terms of wanting a career, you know, as a pilot. But, you know, back then there wasn't commercial flying schools. There wasn't anything like that. So the next step was, if you wanted to fly the fastest planes going, you joined the United States Army, which had an air branch. Mm-hmm. And so he ended up going there. Before there was a U.S. Air Force Academy, the elite flyers were sent to Randolph and Kelly Field down in San Antonio, which later became, you know, Randolph Air Force Base, and which is now Joint Base, you know, San Antonio, Randolph. And that's where he flourished and graduated, went near the top of his class, and ended up being put in charge of a fighter squadron that was deployed to the Philippines just barely a few weeks before the war started.
Well, I was reading the article that you sent me about, because he's in the Texas Hall of Fame, I guess, or he received the Texas Medal of Honor.
Correct.
Their version of it. And I just thought it was really interesting for our listeners to, you know, to know that this guy went to a small high school, Albany High School. I don't even know where Albany, Texas is. I've heard of Shackelford County. I think it was because I went to flight school out in Mineral Wells, Texas.
Okay.
But anyhow, he learned how to fly, as you mentioned, because of the barnstormers going around, and he actually saw Charles Lindbergh when he was about 11 or so.
Correct.
And I can understand why that would fascinate him. But it seems like, you know, you mentioned, or the article talks about him, once he got his wings, that he really kind of took it to the extreme. He was the guy in the class who could do the barrel rolls while he's in a formation. And I know I just flew helicopters, so I can't imagine that. But when people get their rotor blades close to me, I always got nervous.
Right, right.
And so, you know, it sounded like he was such a talented pilot that he was willing to try and do anything. I think he was testing to see what the plane would do.
Right. I mean, he fits the mold of a daredevil. I've obviously made several trips to his hometown in Albany, which is, it's located about 20-30 minutes from Abilene, Texas, which is, you know, a bigger town, but that's where Dyess Air Force Base is located. So that might give you a little bit more of a geographic frame of reference point. But he would be flying, you know, back, you know, whenever he had a chance to sort of get back to his home neck of the woods. The old timers in Albany would tell stories that he would come down and he'd almost be hitting the telephone wires. He would buzz the town, and, you know, they all thought it was the craziest thing in the world. But you know, his mother really had no interest in his career choice. She wasn't very happy.
Well, I again, in the article, it talked about him possibly going to law school, but he decided he didn't want to do that.
Right. Yeah, he was hitchhiking, a summer job. He had graduated from John Tarleton College in Texas in Stephenville, which was fairly close to his home, and was heading to Austin. He was going to, you know, become a lawyer. His father was a judge, and, you know, that was a great, you know, respectable career. But he had, I guess, great fortune, or, if, you know, his mother always called it misfortune, of being picked up while he was hitchhiking by a washout from Randolph, and who was just telling him about how, you know, I wished he could have, you know, made it through flight school, and Dyess was just hooked from there. I think it had always been, you know, sort of, you know, a seed that had been planted when he was young, and, you know, even though he was considering going into law and everything, it was just one of those things that an itch he had to scratch, and he was never gonna do anything else. Let's just say that.
Right. So he graduated from flight school, and then in the first place he sent to is the Philippines as a pilot.
Right.
And he arrives. When did he arrive in the Philippines?
He arrived in the Philippines on Thanksgiving Day, 1941. And, you know, as we know, that December 8th in the Philippines was when the Japanese decided to attack. So he had shown up there. He was already short half of his squadron in terms of personnel. And when he got there, the planes were still being uncrated. None of the guns had been bore sighted. He was really behind the eight ball from the day he got there, and he was, I guess you could say, the tip of the spear, because mm-hmm. you know, we really had nothing else, you know, fortifying some of these distant outposts at the time. But he was one of the individuals earmarked, you know, to do that, and you know, be our military presence overseas as a deterrent, you know, to the Japanese.
Right, and it sounds like he got into action right away.
Day one, as soon as the Japanese attacked, you know, there's obviously the time difference from the international dateline. You know, the attack on Pearl Harbor, which, you know, we just celebrated the 75th anniversary, marked that, you know, last December 8th, and then December 7th, and then December 8th, and the Philippines, they struck, you know, probably about 8 to 9 hours later. And I think that the thing that always sort of gets me, and I remind people, is, you know, I mean, the attack on Pearl Harbor is the one that's really etched into America's memory, but the Japanese came back to the Philippines, and they kept coming back day after day, mm-hmm. week after week, until they were able to knock out pretty much all of our air power, despite what guys like Dias were trying to do. I mean, they were completely outnumbered and outgunned and out-personneled from the very beginning.
Well, we should point out to our audience, we're talking about the Bataan Death March, and how did this occur? And you know, we've always seen the pictures of General MacArthur, you know, leaving and I shall return and so on with that story. But these guys were fighting the Japanese, you know, in the jungles and everything else. And in fact, you know, your book talks about this, is that he lost, you know, they ran out of airplanes. And they ran out of parts, and they ran out of everything else. So the next thing is that Colonel Dias, well, now he's probably a captain at this point, or a first lieutenant.
Right.
And now they've determined that he's going to be an infantry guy.
Yeah, it wasn't by choice, and he wasn't happy with it. His famous line that some of his men had repeated was, when he was out training, you know, they had some of the army guys were, training him in infantry tactics, and Dias always said, I would rather be home in Texas staring at the southbound end of a northbound mule. He wanted to be in a cockpit. He had no interest in messing around the jungle and carrying a rifle. But his sort of frontier West Texas upbringing prepared him better for that more than probably any of the other, his contemporary squadron leaders or any other pilots out there. And he took to it naturally. I mean, the guy knew how to shoot. He was a hell of a leader, mm-hmm. and so he was able to sort of communicate his skills as an infantry leader to his men, and they were among some of the most successful units, despite their lack of training, despite their familiarity with firearms, and anything else. You know, they were able to really turn the situation into gold, which otherwise had been a miserable failure.
Well, it sounds like they fought quite a number of battles while they were there, and I'm trying to read this as we're going along. Where did that go? I don't know if I can pronounce it. Agloloma Bay?
Yeah, Agloloma.
Okay, that's right. Go ahead. What was that one about?
Yeah, there was again, to sort of, cram things into as few words as possible. The Japanese, they had attacked in the Philippines, and after, like you said, that we ran out of planes, we started running out of food, medicine, supplies. The siege started, basically, right around late January 1942. So you figure about 6 weeks after the initial attacks. And these guys, again, they had proven themselves capable warriors and had stopped the Japanese advance into Bataan. So mm-hmm. Japanese General Homa decided to try, an end run, a flanking maneuver, and landed some troops, in the rear echelon area of the Bataan forces. And we didn't really have enough guys to release from the main line of resistance. So we sent a bunch of these, inexperienced, ill-prepared airmen to sort of root these guys out in the jungle. And it took several weeks. It was called the Battle of the Points. But Dias and his airmen were successful in sort of pushing the Japanese to the, to the cliffs, to the shoreline in western Bataan. But as the Japanese, I think everyone is kind of familiar with their way of fighting war, in the latter part of the war, as it became an island hopping campaign, and you're fighting the Japanese position to position, cave to cave, mm-hmm. bunker to bunker. It was a similar situation on Bataan, whereas they had landed behind our lines, and now we had to root them out, but they weren't going to surrender. No way, no how. So then it became Dias's problem to get these guys out of their, their fortified caves and in positions down by the shoreline. And interestingly enough, despite the fact that here's a guy who, you know, had predominantly air training and had made his living in a cockpit, was ordered to lead an amphibious landing.
Yeah, one of the first
in his own territory, which is technically, you know, behind Japanese had landed behind their lines to root these guys out. So he went from, in a matter of probably about 6 weeks, being a pilot to an infantryman to a Marine.
to a Marine as well.
Right.
Okay. Well, the other thing that we want to point out is that during this battle that he was involved in, he received his first Distinguished Service Cross.
Correct. Yes, it was. And, you know, when I was doing the research several years ago before the book, you know, it occurred to me, and I was, again, shocked to realize it, but this was America's first amphibious invasion, first amphibious operation of World War II. And it was led, you know, not by, you know, any famous Marines or, you know, in some of the places where you would think from a frame of reference standpoint, Guadalcanal or, you know, somewhere else. It was, no, it was against an armed enemy. It was in the Philippines, you know, led by a bunch of airmen and a pilot from Texas.
I just think it's a great story, and I encourage everybody to check out this story of William Edward Dias Edwin, because in this article it talks about that he was a hero, and he made heroes, and he got these men to follow him. I can't imagine my flight class, you know, being infantry guys, you know, in such short notice. I'm sure that, you know, that they could do it, but the idea of going from being a pilot to being in the infantry suddenly, and actually participating in battles, and, you know, doing what you were supposed to do. I just can't help but admire this man and all the people of that, you know, of his platoons and companies and stuff. I think it's a great story.
It really is. I mean, you think about, you know, what our troops had to sort of endure and, you know, the odds that they were facing over there. It's, you know, and I always tell people too, and it's not to take away from the experiences or the heroism and the exploits of our troops in any other theater of World War II. But, you know, these guys, Dias and his men, they were doing it on empty stomachs, and they were all carrying between 1 in 4 tropical diseases. That was one of the certain general of the armed forces reports after the war. So these guys were sick, hungry, and, you know, there was no R&R for them. There were no USO shows. You know, Japanese jammed the radios. There was very little, you know, you were really fighting in an information vacuum, no letters from home. And to keep withstanding.
You still there? I think I just lost John. I might have. Well, I'll kind of try and finish this story while we make recontact with him, and we're going to be coming up on a break here at the bottom of the hour. But we were talking to John Lucas, who is the author of a book about Lieutenant Colonel William Edwin Dias. And his book is called Escape from Davao, D-A-V-A-O. And he's also got a documentary about this exciting guy that's called 4-4-43. And we're going to talk about that. This is the breakout from that prison, the Japanese prisoner of war camp that he was in. And you can find more information about this by just going to Amazon or going, you know, Googling John's name in there. It's John Lucas. Lucas, it's L-U-K-A-C-S. L-U-K-A-C-S. He went to Notre Dame, which is okay. But he put together this story. And so when we come back after the news, which I think I've got about a minute to go before we get to that, is that we will go back to the story of when the colonel broke out of the Japanese prisoner of war camp. Because this, again, it's a frightening story. Okay, I guess we have John back on the line.
Of that, I don't know if the Japanese army had jammed the signals there or what the situation was.
I think so. Well, you know, I was saving this till the second half, but we know that the American government tried to jam his story, so we figure maybe they were doing that again. I got about 30 seconds. I got 30 seconds, John. We're going to take a break at the news, and then when we come back, we're going to talk about him getting back in the air again.
Great.
So hold on. We'll be right back about 2 minutes. You're listening to Veterans Radio. We'll be right back after the news. And we're back on Veterans Radio, and we are talking with John Lucas, who's the producer of a documentary 4-4-43, which we'll explain in a little bit, and also the author of the book Escape from, how do I pronounce this? Is it Davao?
Davao.
Davao. Okay. Davao, the forgotten story of the most daring prison break of the Pacific War. And we are talking specifically about William Edward Dyess, who was a captain at the time. Actually, he ended up being a lieutenant colonel by the time he was 27. And so he's been fighting against the Japanese because, you know, they invaded the Philippines the same time that they dropped the bombs on Pearl Harbor. And he's gone from being a pilot to being an infantry guy, and now he gets to go back to be a pilot for a little while.
Yes, that was probably the highlight of the war for him personally, was his return to flight status.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, it was you know, one of those difficult promotions, because he was in charge of what was called the Bamboo Fleet, or the Bamboo Air Force. It was just a small handful of planes. It was basically whatever could be cobbled together by the mechanics left on Bataan, basically a bunch of planes. There were a small handful of P-40 Warhawks, a few fighter planes, but most of them were, you know, unarmed civilian planes that had been commandeered and cobbled together. And they used those basically, you know, for reconnaissance missions, and some flights south into the Philippines to the Visayan Islands, to Mindanao for supply runs. So there wasn't a lot of actual combat, air-to-air, you know, combat going on, and that was what, you know, basically Dyess had trained for. That is, you know, what he had rehearsed for in preparation for this, you know, for this big show. So it was kind of tough in the beginning, but he ended up convincing his superiors to let him take a crack at the Japanese.
Yeah, and it talks about that these airplanes, as you mentioned, that were kind of, I don't know, kind of put together with pieces of other airplanes, really the only thing they could do is drop bombs. And not a whole lot of them. It seemed like they would take one bomb out, drop it, and come back and get another one.
Yeah, it was a very, you know, frustrating, painstaking, you know, method of waging war. But you know, these guys had really, really little choice. One of the individuals who was Dyess's, you know, chief engineer at the airfields on Bataan was a really intelligent, great guy, Leo Bolins, from a small town in Wyoming. Just, you know, one of those mechanical geniuses who, you know, could do anything with, you know, a wrench and, you know, some baling wire. And he actually built a plane. They called it the P-40 something because it had so many different parts from different models. From B's, from C's, from E's, that they just called it the P-40 something. But it was flyable and it worked, and they were able to use it, you know, on strafing attacks. And they also figured out a way to rig these P-40s up with 500-pound general-purpose bombs, which was against the original design specifications.
Sure.
They were never designed to be a dive bomber with that type of load. But, you know, something they worked on, and they built some, you know, contraptions that would enable them to, you know, release these bombs. And again, Dyess had finally convinced his superiors, you know, that they needed to start hitting the Japanese, both for morale purposes, but, you know, in terms of strategy, if they were just going to sit there and take it all the time, it would be only a matter of time until the, you know, the eventual end would come. So finally he was able to launch an attack on a Japanese supply depot in Subic Bay, which is, you know, a little bit north of Bataan. And when he did it, it was, again, with a small handful of these really beat-up, battered warplanes, but he had extraordinary results.
Well, it sounds like a you know, just a great pilot as well. Just kind of to back up a little bit, let our audience know that he, in today's world, or even in World War II, he would have been considered an ace in the first couple of days after the Philippines were invaded.
Right.
But they didn't have the nose cameras and so forth at the time.
So exactly. That was the case, you know, and you didn't have that, you know, the corroborative evidence.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it's one of those deals, you know, we go back to the beginning, you know, of the show, and you're talking about how you didn't know anything about Dyess, and, you know, I had sort of stumbled upon his story. It's just a shame that, you know, he had all these extraordinary adventures and exploits, but he did it during a part of the war where we were losing. Mm-hmm. And a part of the war where the record keeping, the documentation wasn't up to the standards of the later war, and there were only a small handful of reporters embedded with these troops. There was no newsreel footage, you know, no radio reports, and, you know, so really his story didn't get out there, and it's a shame, because there just really isn't that paper trail where you have for, you know, later in the war, where we had, you know, this huge news gathering operation with all branches of the service and the, you know, the integration with different media outlets, and, you know, so there was just nobody really knew about what this guy had done, and he had done some of the most extraordinary things of any of, you know, U.S. soldier, airman, sailor throughout the course of the entire war.
Well, I have, yeah, I totally agree with you on that. And that, you know, we want to make sure that Dias's name gets out there and that people find out more and more about him, because as the, you know, America kind of went to this Europe first before the, you know, the war in the Pacific. And as you mentioned, you know, all the attention was on Europe and not necessarily on the Pacific. All right. So eventually we know that the American troops in the Philippines were captured. Those that didn't escape or weren't evacuated, and he chose not to be evacuated also. That's another thing that I think is important to point out to people.
Definitely. And, you know, I think, Dale, and, you know, you look at this and you call somebody a hero, and I think, and it's true, he does have these extraordinary moments where he's, I was listening to, between the commercial there, the Medal of Honor segment mm-hmm. that you had, and, you know, and I think he had those moments where he's on the ground leading an amphibious landing. He was the first man on the beach, bullets flying everywhere, exposing himself to enemy fire, trying to rally his troops. Here he is, you know, dive bombing with a plane that shouldn't probably wouldn't even be airworthy. They wouldn't even use it as a trainer in the States at this time. And here he is attacking, engaging Japanese cruisers, you know, anti-aircraft fire. So he has these sort of, you know, for lack of a better word, Rambo moments where it's him against the entire Imperial Japanese Army. But then I think the other part of it is, and what makes him really special is the fact that, you know, while these guys are starving and running out of medicine on Bataan, there was an incident where the higher ups provided additional rations for the pilots to be able to, you know, because these guys couldn't crawl in and out of their cockpits. They were so sick and in such bad shape. But Dias, true to form, you know, he understood that there was a lot of resentment among the enlisted men, between the officers, guys who he thought, you know, had more mm-hmm. perks and things like that. And he, before he even took any of these additional rations or vitamin pills, he went and cleared it, you know, with his, gathered his sergeants mm-hmm. together and said, I want you to talk to the men. If it's okay with them, get back to me. And, you know, and they were just, they understood because they knew the guy. They all said they would follow him anywhere, you know, into hell and back, whatever it would do. But, you know, that just shows you what the type of guy he was, where other people would, you know, would take advantage of those opportunities. But yet he felt guilty. And then that same attitude and the same, you know, unselfishness manifested itself a few weeks later when Bataan fell and he had been ordered out. You know, I mean, there was no value for a talented squadron leader, daredevil pilot behind barbed wire. So, you know, MacArthur wanted all these guys evacuated so they could, you know, reconstitute their units and be flying again against the enemy, you know, elsewhere. But Dias, he probably in subordination, he didn't want to follow orders, but he felt his men were family. Mm-hmm. And there was no way he was going to evacuate. He wasn't going to leave them behind. So he sort of went out on his own mission, you know, sending out everybody but himself on all these last planes that were leaving the Philippines before the eventual surrender.
Well, and eventually they did surrender and they were captured and they were forced to go on this march, which was, how long was the Bataan Death March?
You know, Dale, it really depends on where you were, where you surrendered, where you were mm-hmm. captured, where you started. From beginning to end, the average length of the Death March was about 60 to 70 miles.
Wow.
And again, depending on all those different circumstances and, you know, your geographic position, the march could have taken anywhere from 3 or 4 days to about 2 weeks. And it depends on, you know, some guys had the great fortune to be picked up and thrown into trucks mm-hmm. and driven half the duration of the march. Other guys walked from beginning to end, you know, probably 80, 90 miles. And so, you know, it's hard to pinpoint the number of troops who are on it, the distance and things like that. But there are some sort of generic, you know, averages and values you can put towards it.
Well, we know that there were many, many atrocities that were committed during that march against the American and the Philippine soldiers that were forced to do that march. And the stories are just so graphic and just so disturbing when you get a chance to read them. We don't need to necessarily go into detail about those today. Suffice it to say, though, is that he made it, and then he was in a prisoner of war camp. How long was he in the prisoner of war camp before he attempted his escape?
Well, he was actually in, there were three camps that he had sort of transited through at the conclusion of the march until he made his eventual escape. And he spent exactly 361 days in captivity, surrendered on April 9th, 75 years ago today, mm-hmm. and then went to Camp O'Donnell, which was in Luzon, Cabanatuan prison camp, which was a few miles away, similarly located in Luzon, north of Manila, and then was sent to the Davao Penal Colony, which is located in the island of Mindanao, which was about 600 miles south of Bataan and Corregidor in the Manila Bay area. And it's kind of interesting because, you know, these guys, you talk about the death march, and it's hard to believe, you know, it was 75 years ago. A lot of these guys thought that the death march was the worst part of the whole ordeal. They figured, okay, once we get through this, you know, we'll get to a camp.
Right.
You know, the Geneva Convention will take over. The Japanese, they have to feed us. They have to give us water, medicine. That wasn't the case. They were in for a shock that the Japanese in all these camps were either going to just let them die, or, as in the case of Dias, he was with a group of guys who were sent to this southern camp. It was called the Alcatraz of the Philippines. It was basically a work plantation. Mm-hmm. So the Japanese had no intention of just letting these guys sit around and, you know, sort of while away the rest of the war. They were going to put them to work as slave laborers and kill as many as they could in the process. So, you know, whatever they weren't able to do in the battlefields of Bataan, they would do it, you know, to the prisoners of war just through this, you know, ridiculous, extremely demanding work schedule.
Oh, okay, so tell us about his escape.
Well, he, you know, I think, you know, we had discussed his personality a few times. Mm-hmm. This guy was really, he was one of those never give up type individuals. And I think he'd always been thinking about escaping in all the camps he had been to, even though that the conditions were just, you know, the right opportunity never really presented itself until he got to Davao, because he realized that the Japanese there, they had been so confident in the fact that they were going to win the war. And plus the fact that this camp was considered escape-proof. It had been built by the Philippine government about 10 years before the war started, and no civilian prisoner had ever gotten out of there. It was surrounded by a swamp on all sides. There were 10-foot Philippine crocodiles that roamed in this swamp. There was reportedly headhunters that, you know, frequented into the area, different tribes. And, you know, in all of these factors, basically the Japanese let their guard down. They got lax. And Dias, at the time, he teamed up. There were two U.S. Army Air Force guys, friends of his from his unit, that he recruited. And then he put in with a group of Marines, a triumvirate of Marines, who had been on Corregidor. And then they latched on with an Army-Navy group. And there were a few Army Coast Artillery guys, two enlisted men in the group. The rest were officers. And finally, a Navy commander, who was a graduate of the Naval Academy, and he graduated with the highest degree in mathematics, one of the highest averages that I think has ever been achieved there. And so he was a real intelligent, you know, great leader type. And these guys basically put together, you know, an impossible mission type plan, you know, with all their different distinct traits and talents.
All right. And so they got out.
Yes, they did. They succeeded in getting out, and it was one of those remarkable deals where, you know, it's, you know, I don't want to, you know, tell everyone the whole story.
No.
Obviously, you know, you want to, you know, leave some suspense there, but they, you know, they pulled it off, and they had to trudge through the swamp and go through all the previously indicated obstacles, and even, you know, some that one wouldn't even think of before they reached safe territory. But there were, luckily for them, they had run into a group of Filipino guerrillas, you know, the resistance that had formed up as soon as the Japanese began to occupy the Philippines. And, you know, through some unbelievable, you know, an unbelievable series or string of fortunate events that were, you know, that they had even said were, you know, were without probably divinely inspired, you know, that it couldn't have happened any other way than, if, you know, how these guys got to friendly territory. They met up with individuals there who could take care of them, facilitate their transfer, you know, through these, you know, jungled areas and all the way through the hinterlands of this, you know, wild island of Mindanao. And finally, a few months later, got in touch with a radio, shortwave radio broadcast that could dial up General MacArthur in Australia. And he sent a submarine to get him. Easy as that.
There you go. Zip, zip, zap, he's out.
Right.
But being out wasn't, it was probably almost more difficult than being in it. It sounds like in reading your book and watching your documentary and all the other articles about Dies and his story of when he got home was not, you know, he wasn't welcomed with parades and so forth.
Right. And that's probably the most important, you know, climax to the story, or, you know, a closing impact is, you know, when these guys were in this prison camp, and, you know, and the genesis for the idea, like I said, it formed, you know, before they got to the penal colony, the Alcatraz of the Philippines. You know, they wanted to break out. And, you know, when these guys did form this team to to get out, you know, it wasn't to save their own skins. They had a plan that they understood that the rest of the world, the free world, outside of, you know, this bamboo curtain that the Japanese had drawn across the Pacific, had no clue of what was going on to these captured personnel, you know, way behind enemy lines. And they figured if they could get out, it was their mission to break the news of the world to the Bataan Death March and to these atrocities that the Japanese were committing against American as well as, you know, Allied prisoners of war throughout the Far East. And so they thought that was their number one self-assigned mission, was to get out and break this news, to have these revelations sort of fire up the American people. And, you know, so they got home, you kind of think, wow, these guys would be big heroes and, you know, ticker tape parades and flash bulbs and, you know, and radio mm-hmm. shows. But, you know, the U.S. government had a different idea of, of, you know, this story and when it should come out and even how it should come out. And, you know, it was completely opposite of, you know, of what Dias and the others thought. So, you know, it's really a tragic concluding aspect of the story that, you know, that they weren't appreciated and in many respects that, you know, the government muzzled them and threatened these guys, you know. So it was, in many ways, it was a second imprisonment. You know, you think that once you set foot on, you know, the, mm-hmm. you know, the continental United States, that you had made it and that the mission was accomplished. But that was completely opposite.
Well, you mentioned in your documentary and also in some of the other articles is that Dias, you know, probably understandably had a little bit of post-traumatic stress going on.
Definitely.
And when the government tried to shut him down, I think his independence streak rose up again. And didn't he, again, we don't have to give the whole story away. It's just such a great story. But he was trying to get this story out, not using the normal channels, let's put it that way.
Correct.
And he was finally able to get somebody to interview him, wasn't he?
He was fortunate in that his wife, her father, her family owned, they were sort of, you know, I'm going to say media moguls, but they owned mm-hmm. newspapers and radio stations in the Midwest, and specifically in Champaign, Illinois, where she was from.
Oh, okay.
And they obviously had connections, you know, in the, you know, through different media markets. And his wife remembered that, you know, the family had connections with the Chicago Tribune, which at the time was one of the biggest newspapers in terms of circulation reach, but all the associate papers owned throughout North America.
Right.
And figured this would be the way to get the story out to the largest possible audience and to achieve the desired effect of what Dias and his comrades had wanted to do. And so it was very fortunate they had those contacts and were able to, you know, sort of get the process started. But again, the U.S. government, the European war was most important. We were gearing up for the D-Day invasion, you know, only a few months later. Mm-hmm. And it was a very tenuous arrangement with Great Britain, France, and all these other governments in exile. And I think that they successfully or probably successfully, you know, put two and two together that, boy, if the American people found out about what the Japanese were doing to our troops, and, you know, what a horrible, awful theater of war this was, that there would be such a huge clamor to junk, you know, the whole Allied apple cart and, you know, get rid of the Europe first strategy and throw the bulk of our resources towards the defeat of Japan. And I think they correctly assumed that would be the case. So in other words, this story had to be suppressed at all costs because it could sincerely and definitely change the course of the war.
Well, I think they finally ended up, you know, it looks like they ended up using it as a, you know, as a PR piece to generate, you know, interest in the war and, you know, probably increase war bonds and how are we going to pay for this? If we're going to do this two-front war, we've got to do this. And I'm reading the cover. I'm looking at the cover of the Chicago Sunday Tribune. It says, and it says, Dias's own story tells Jap torture on Bataan Death March. And part of it is that he also mentions that some of the headlines of the story trumpeted by the War Department is the greatest story of the war in the Pacific, the biggest bombshell since Pearl Harbor, probably the most important news break of the war. And I think I have to agree with that. I think we all had these preconceptions of what we learned in our history classes and probably more about what we saw in the movies.
Right.
You know, growing up during that time, after that time period, I'm not quite that old, but I just can't believe that they would stifle this whole thing. I mean, this guy was a genuine, you know, we always talk about on our program about these ordinary people that do extraordinary things.
Right.
And this is what he did. He was just this ordinary guy from Texas that every time something needed to be done, he did it. You know, and it's just unfortunate that he never really, you know, got to bathe in that glory of, you know, what he had done and what he had accomplished. And I think I want to make sure that, you know, that we tell our audience, you know, where they can get your books and so forth, and especially where they can check out that documentary. So you want to give us a little information there?
Sure. You know, there's actually two different websites, two different locations, 4-4-43.com. That's the name of the documentary. You can just type that into your browser, and the two things there, you can watch a trailer of the film. And I also would like to request, if you've been, you know, significantly moved by this interview and this discussion, there is a petition that we're trying to, you know, make the government reconsider Colonel Dias's candidacy for the Medal of Honor. He could have received it as many as four times. He's officially nominated once, but no go on any of those. And we're trying to sort of stir up. It's a grassroots movement of people to support his candidacy. And we're going to be getting started with that through different politicians in Texas, people who are sort of taking up this fight. And I'm happy we have a lot of, you know, sort of famous individuals, Secretary of Defense and General James Mattis was probably one of the most, you know, enthusiastic backers of Colonel Dias. I had a chance to talk to him and share Dias's story with him in the documentary. He loved it, called me at home and told me, you know, these are the kind of guys we need to honor, and, you know, and really got behind us there. But as you know, the way an army fights and the way an army wins, it's not always the guys with the four stars in their shoulders like Mattis. We need the, you know, the yeah. grunts and you know, the guys in the trenches here to sign this petition and help us out. So I'd really would make, you know,
well, I'm going to encourage
help it
people.
Out if people could sign that. But there's also yeah. an opportunity. You can purchase the film DVDs, you know, through that website there.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, all the proceeds go towards this mission and, you know, to sort of help our lobbying efforts and, you know, to get him this award that he genuinely deserves.
Well, I totally agree with you. And you know, that just the things that he did is, you know, he should be a part of our Medal of Honor series that we have out there. And we're going to encourage everybody we know to support and sign that petition. And we know we have a Medal of Honor recipient in our local area from the Vietnam era. It took almost 40 years for him to get upgraded to the Medal of Honor.
Mm-hmm.
So we know how difficult it can be. And, wow. So, and also, what about the book? So where do we get the book?
The book is pretty much available, you know, to use a war film, Casablanca, all the usual suspects. You can go online to Amazon, places like that, you know, Barnes & Noble bookstores, or folks, if they would like a specially inscribed, a signed copy, they can log on to my website, which is my name, John, J-O-H-N, D as in Douglas, Lucas, LUKACS.com, JohnDLucas.com. And I can, you know, get a signed copy, which are, you know, great gifts, as well as the DVD, you know, for Father's Day and graduations and things like that coming up. And, you know, but again, it's not just all about making money. It's, you know, trying to get Colonel Dias' story out, and that way more people sort of know about this guy that no one's heard of, you know, this great untold story and great untold hero.
Absolutely, you know. John. I hear the orchestra coming up under me. So I've got to thank you very much for being on Veterans Radio, and we will be in touch with you to help promote Dias more.
Yeah, no, thanks.
Okay? Thank you very much.
It was great to be on. I really appreciate it, and I want to thank you and your audience as well. Thank you.
Thank you. And you are dismissed.